This is a Glass Box Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Welcome to This Week in Travel, the show that talks to some of the most interesting and notable travelers in the world. Learn about the top travel stories from the world of travel, get valuable travel tips, and have some fun in the process. Now here are your hosts, Gary Arndt and Jen Leo.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of This Week in Travel. My name is Gary Arndt, coming to you from a starting-to-get-chilly Wisconsin. Going to get my second vaccination shot right after I'm done with this show, so I'll be all set to travel again. And I'll be making, actually, my first trip anywhere in 18 months in a couple days, going to the SATW convention in Milwaukee. So looking forward to that. With me, as always, Jen Leo. How are you doing, Jen?
I'm doing great. Gary, I'm so excited you're going to get back on the road.
Yeah, it's not as what it seems. Like, I'm not taking a plane flight. I'm actually just taking a bus because it's so close to – I mean, I'm going to Milwaukee.
And how come you're not driving?
Because it's cheaper and easier because it's literally – the bus station is three blocks from the hotel. So I can get a $25 bus ticket. And that's way cheaper. I mean, gas prices are really expensive right now. So I would pay more in gas one way, plus 4 or 5 days of parking on top of that. So why not just take the bus?
That's smart. And so they're having – what are the rules for the convention? Like, do people have to be vaccinated to attend, or do you have to test?
You have to be vaccinated or have a test within, like, the last 72 hours. So kind of the same as if you were, you know, on a flight or something. That's pretty much it. And I'll be speaking there this year on the subject of why you need to really consider podcasting. Because I've become it. It's a huge, basically my life at this point. So I'm like, Oh, and as an aside, before we get too far into it, Jen, I know you've been doing a lot of stuff with like Bitcoin and whatnot.
Yes.
I am actually running my own Bitcoin and Lightning node.
Gary, you went from a non-believer to fully on board?
Well, the node is actually very simple. It's not like I'm mining or something. I just have a cheap Raspberry Pi that I'm running it on. And I'm sure you saw Twitter just rolled out that you can do tipping and stuff now.
Yep,
with
tipping on Bitcoin.
Lightning wallets. And that's basically what I have set up for this show as well. So, you know, people could send money. So I think it's starting to take off, especially the Lightning Network stuff. So I just wanted to learn more about it, and I thought it was the easiest way to do it. So that's what I did. It was actually not that hard. It just took a little bit of time to get everything synced up.
Interesting. Maybe I smell a new podcast in our future. But let's get back to our special guest.
Yeah, we have, I think, a great show lined up today. He is coming all the way in from Nook, Greenland. So that's a first. I mean, we've been doing this for 12 years. I don't think we've had Greenland. We've had a mile underground. We've had almost Antarctica. I remember doing it from Fiji, but never Greenland. And he's the CEO of Visit Greenland, Hjörtur Samuelsson. How much did I butcher it?
It's okay. It's okay. You did well enough. I'll live with it.
And most importantly, you're part of the you're one of the authors of a book that just came out this week called Aftershocks and Opportunities 2, Navigating the Next Horizon, which is kind of a forward-looking futurist type book, right?
That's correct, Gary. Yeah. So it came out yesterday, and we are really excited about it. And there are 37 experts that are writing about the future post-COVID and what the impacts are in the long run. And I have a chapter there about the future of tourism, which is, of course, a topic that is interesting to all of us here.
Well, let's get into that. Let's start out with how did the pandemic affect tourism to Greenland? which is not a huge destination. Well, area-wise, I guess it's huge, but in terms of incoming visitors, it isn't. So what did it do for Greenland?
That's correct. I mean, Greenland is a huge island. It's 2 million square kilometers, and there are only 56,000 people living here. So it's a very big destination, but at the same time, as you say, a very small destination in terms of the number of tourists that come here. But it also means that healthcare is very tricky in this landscape. I mean, no towns are connected by roads. So if someone gets really sick, you need to evacuate them with helicopters. This means that the authorities, they simply close down the country entirely. So for a year and a half, there was pretty much no tourism at all in Greenland. There was a short period in the summer of 2020 when it opened up partially again. But then it closed down again and was closed until the mid of June, when small numbers of tourists were allowed to enter the country, about 1,000 per week. So it has, of course, had a huge impact on tourism here. Operators have been struggling. It's been hard for them. But on the flip side, there have been no fatalities in the entire country because of COVID.
Well, that was going to be my next question. Yeah. How did the actual virus affect you?
Yeah, it didn't. That's the short version of it. And I mean, I came here in April. I'm pretty new in this job. The country was still closed at that time. I got an exception to come in because of my role as the CEO of Visit Greenland. And it was wonderful to come here, and everything was open. People didn't use masks anywhere. I could go to restaurants, and it was just like normal life pre-COVID. Which was very refreshing.
Do you have any policies or procedures in place for visitors that want to go to Greenland right now, as far as like vaccinations or testing?
Yes, we do. So the restrictions have been lifted slowly. It means that there are still restrictions on number that can come in. They will be lifted next month. But you still have to be fully vaccinated to be allowed to enter the country. You also need to have a PCR test, and there are only Nordic PCR tests that are accepted, meaning from Finland, Sweden, Norway, Denmark, Iceland, or the Faroe Islands, which doesn't really affect you that much because the only routes into the country are via Copenhagen or via Reykjavik, Iceland.
Is that something current, or has it always been that way? Because I believe that you could fly from Canada at one point.
There have been some experiments with flights from Canada and also with flights from Baltimore, U.S., but these haven't really been viable economically. So for most of the part, it's been only Copenhagen and Reykjavik, Iceland, where you've been able to fly in.
Excellent. And Jen, go ahead.
Yeah, when you said that the incoming tourists were about 1,000 a day, I think you said. What was the previous number?
1,000 per week, not per day.
1,000 per week.
Yeah,
1,000 per week.
Very, very low number. If we look at the pre-COVID numbers, the numbers were 100,000 per year. That was the 2019 number. Almost half of them come with cruise ships, and no cruise ships have been allowed into the country since the start of COVID. And the country will open up next year for cruise ships, so 2022. So that eliminated half. The other half came via planes, so 35% via Iceland and the rest via Copenhagen, Denmark.
What type of cruise ships are the ones that go to Greenland? Are these expedition ships, or are these the larger, you know, get drunk and go to senior frog type ships?
Yeah, there are some big ships that come here, but primarily these are expedition ships, also because the capacity of the ports where they call is quite limited. So we have difficulties in handling the larger ships. We focus primarily on the expedition ships, so ships with under 500 tourists or passengers, and that has been working very, very well. There are some interesting ships also in that category. We are seeing some hybrid ships coming into the market, which suits our sustainability vision very, very well. And you even have some sail ships where you can sail along the coast. And that also looks absolutely fabulous. I haven't tried it myself, but the images are stunning, simply stunning.
You're from Iceland originally, and Iceland went through a period where they had I guess it was around 2008 when they had the recession. They had a lot of problems, the currency collapse, and then it seemed to have come back, tourism, really strong. Like, tourism to Iceland kind of took off, almost to a point where there was a lot of talk of it was too much tourism, that over-tourism was a problem. I actually went through Reykjavik a few years ago, and I had last been there in 1999, and it was really different. A lot of development in the city.
Correct.
Why did Icelandic tourism take off so much? And do you think that maybe not to the degree that Iceland did, because you don't have the same resources, but what would it take to increase tourism to Greenland to a much larger extent than what you have now?
Well, it's a very valid question. This is, of course, one of the reasons why I am in this position today. It's because I know the story of Iceland and both what has worked and what hasn't worked. And it's interesting to think about. In 2010, there were around 500,000 tourists in Iceland, and it reached the level of 2.2 million in 2019, which is almost fivefold in less than 10 years. And there are a couple of things that supported this. Of course, the recession in 2008 meant that the currency collapsed and everything became much cheaper. It had been a very expensive destination before that. And all of a sudden, it became much more viable to travel to Iceland. In 2010, we had a big event which made headlines all around the world. And of course, when you're trying to market the country, that's what you're always trying to do. Except these weren't very positive headlines. It was the grounding of airlines all over Europe because of a volcanic eruption, which you may recall, especially those of you who are in the travel industry, the Eyjafjallajökull eruption in 2010. So that was a crisis. And it's interesting, you get so different answers depending on who you ask on why tourism boomed after that. If you ask people on the street, they're going to tell you it's all because of the volcano, because people learned about Iceland, it made the headlines, and then they got curious about what the country was and came to visit, which is, of course, partly true. If you ask someone with Promote Iceland, they're going to tell you it's because of the Inspired by Iceland campaign, which was absolutely brilliant. And they really managed to grab the attention that Iceland got and make the most of it and tell the story of Iceland. So that was very well done. And then again, if you ask someone in marketing, and in particular in digital marketing, they're going to tell you it's all because of social media and influencers. I mean, sure, Promote Iceland got some millions of views on the videos, but then you had maybe a single photographer that got twice as many views on the videos of the eruption or of a nice mountain or a waterfall or something like that. So that has had an impact as well. And then finally, if you ask someone in aviation, it's because of the new airlines that started to fly in. You had two airlines flying to Iceland before the eruption, and you had 22 a few years later. And of course, each airline that comes in comes with a marketing channel. They have maybe 600,000 or 3 million email addresses that they can send direct offers to, and they have their sales network as well. Reality is a combination of all of this. And so this is what we're looking at here in Greenland. What is it that we can do? How can we approach this in a systematic way so that we attract new airlines, we grab the attention of the media, we develop infrastructure here? Because, as you say, it became a challenge in Iceland. And you might think that 2.2 million, that's way too much, it's this mass tourism. The feeling of mass tourism was actually bigger when we had 1.2 million tourists in Iceland than when we had 2.2 million. And the reason is simply infrastructure hadn't caught up with the development. So there were way more tourists than we could handle. Then Iceland invested in infrastructure, in parking lots, in toilet and service facilities, in pathways, in rails and platforms, marked hiking routes, etc. And of course, the building of new hotels and restaurants. So it was much easier to handle the 2.2 million than it was the 1.2 million. And this is something that we have learned from here in Greenland. And there are two new airports being built, one in Nuuk and one in Ilulissat, which is the main tourism destination where you have the large icebergs. And that is going to create great opportunities for attracting new airlines when they're ready at the end of 2024. So we have this window of 3 to 4 years to build hotels, to develop restaurants and the local cuisine, and to invest in the micro infrastructure that we need, whether it's docks and harbors, pathways, or what else, so that we can handle the amount of people.
And maybe 3 to 4 years for travelers to come see Greenland before it grows, for those that would rather see it the way it is now before it gets too inundated with the average tourist, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. Now is the right time to come before everyone else does. You know, if you want to be the trendsetter, this is the moment.
Absolutely. So I have a couple questions, which are usually on the front burner of people who are needing to be somewhere else, but also still need to be in touch with their work. How is the Wi-Fi and how is your Airbnb set up?
excellent questions. The Wi-Fi, in most of the country, there is no Wi-Fi, which is absolutely wonderful, getting off the grid. In the big towns, you have excellent Wi-Fi. I mean, I'm speaking over Wi-Fi at the moment here from Nuuk, and there are no problems at all. So you can definitely come here and work and use the Wi-Fi. But you need to be in one of the larger settlements or larger towns. If you go into the more rural areas, the Wi-Fi might become a challenge in the small settlements and towns. So, yeah, it's a matter of doing a little research before you choose the destination if you want to work remotely.
Yes.
I was going to ask you about a question something that I've been bringing up on the show quite a bit. Have you looked into Starlink access for a lot of these villages? And well, because I think Greenland is a natural place where Starlink could dramatically affect some of these places. You know, otherwise running a fiber cable or something would be extremely expensive, whereas putting up a dish is cheap.
Yeah, I think Starlink sounds absolutely fabulous, and I'm really excited about the potential it opens up. I think the area they're covering to start with does not cover Greenland, unfortunately. But I would love to see Starlink cover Greenland because it would just be perfect for the kind of landscape and remoteness that we have here. I mean, just to put it into context, the distances are so large that and you can't really travel between places. So, it is a big challenge, but Starlink would be perfect for Greenland.
Can you give us a little taste for what the difference is travel-wise between North Greenland and South Greenland? What could we expect to see in each of those places?
I think when people think of Greenland, the first images that come to their minds are the icebergs and the dog sleds. So dog sledding is a big part of the culture. But it's still, it surprises a lot of people that in Nuuk and in Southern Greenland, there are no dog sleds. That's not a mode of transport that's used in this region. And the reason is very simple. You use dog sleds where the fjords freeze in the wintertime. If the fjord doesn't freeze in the wintertime, it's really not a good mode of transportation. Then you just use boats instead. So you have dog sleds on the east coast and then north of the Arctic Circle on the west coast. In southern Greenland, you have, the reason why the country is called Greenland. You have very green agricultural areas. You have a lot of sheep, fantastic hiking routes. You have some hot springs and even Viking ruins from Viking settlers that came here 1,000 years ago and then sailed onwards and discovered America. Well, it was a discovery for them, at least. Leif the Lucky, if you've heard about him and his voyage to America, he lived in Greenland and he sailed from South Greenland, where his farm was and still is. The ruins are there. You also have the first church in Northern America outside his farm.
Let's talk a little bit about the book. And it's kind of a forward-looking book about, you know, the future, and you talked about the future of tourism. What do you think is the primary lesson, or the change, I should say, that's going to come out of the pandemic for tourism and destinations? What's going to be different, say, 2 years from now as opposed to 2 years ago?
Yeah. If we look at what people have been talking about when it comes to tourism and the pandemic, The main narrative is that it has halted tourism development, and we will not be at the pre-COVID level until 2024 or 2025. And I really think that narrative is missing the point. It's focusing solely on numbers. If we think about the trends that have been in tourism, I think we are seeing an acceleration in the development. I think we're leaping 5 to 10 years ahead. And it's primarily because of more focus on sustainability, different types of products that we need to think about, change in demand. We see already that there is an increased demand for rural travel. So instead of people going to the most crowded places, they want to go somewhere where they're more secluded, out in nature, experiencing more peacefulness and quiet maybe. We see this in the UK where the Water District is popular, or Wales. We see this in Europe. We see this in the US where Alaska is leading the way in tourism recovery. And this is, of course, positive for us here in Greenland. Before COVID, we also had fly shaming. And now we have a double challenge, because it's not just fly shaming and the climate you need to think about when you choose a destination to fly to, but it is also diseases and risks. So people are going to choose places that are closer by, that are more familiar, where they feel more safe. And also, if they're going to fly, they need to be able to justify why they're flying to that destination. It's not enough that it's just for entertainment. It has to have a higher purpose.
What do you mean by fly shaming? Have I been living in a cave, Gary? Are you familiar with fly shaming?
I think that during the pandemic, there were a lot of people that were pretty much looking down on people that were flying.
Well, I think it's a term that was coined by Greta Thunberg, flyskam in Swedish. So it's become a big trend in Sweden before the pandemic. And it was that you should rather drive or use a train instead of flying to your destination. So, Gary, you were scoring there with your bus trip to Milwaukee. So it's more about climate and the CO2 footprint you leave with your travel, because, we have to admit or face that flying is not the most sustainable way of traveling.
Mm-hmm.
Just to kind of go back, I think I've talked about this on the show. I've always been a big believer. Well, I was kind of hoping that things like Starlink and the ability to be online would actually help drive more people to travel to Europe by ship from North America. Because with more people working remotely, if you could be productive on a ship, you could spend 3 or 4 days on a boat, more comfortable than an airplane, get stuff done, sleep in a real bed, eat real food, arrive without jet lag, not a problem. And I keep hoping that this, as an alternative will kind of appear. The voyages you take across the Atlantic right now are always either repositioning cruises, which only happen once a year, or it's something like what Cunard does, where they try to turn it into this glamorous Titanic-like experience, which I don't, there are some people that want to do that. But as far as just like a utilitarian, I need to get to Europe, really doesn't cut it. So, yeah, I think that there's an opportunity for more of that in the future.
Yeah, I mean, I think a Titanic experience is maybe not the right selling point. but other than that, I think it sounded really good the way you described it. And I think this is also the way we're going to see travel. People are going to not do city hopping, but they're going to travel slower. They're going to fly to a destination and they're going to spend more time there, going to immerse themselves more in the location they are and explore the vicinity. So they maybe have one or two accommodation options they're using instead of 5 or 6 before.
Yeah, I think that there's going to be a rise of people that, work. I'm seeing it already of people that are like digital nomads, and they have that time to work remotely. They're not as pressed, so they don't need to get to Europe in like 4 hours or something and be back in 2 days and be in the office. So that's going to open up a lot of opportunities and new forms of transportation and also new ways of staying places. I'm actually doing a tour next year for my other podcast. And what I'm doing is in the past when I've done tours, it's like, okay, we go to this city, we go to this city, we go to that city. I'm going to do 10 days in Rome, one city, one hotel room, leave your stuff. And we're just going to explore it more in depth than we otherwise would have. And it turns out there's a lot of demand for that kind of tour, where it's just staying in one place and seeing it more in depth than there was for jumping around.
Precisely. Gary, I think that's definitely one of the trends and one of the things that tourism operators need to think about when they think about their product development and how they're going to react to the pandemic.
Gary, I love the idea of the 10 days in Rome for you. And also, are you going to make a map where your map of Rome includes the different podcast episodes from Rome and all the historic information that you were given so that they can sort of not just see the city, but visually see a map of the education that they've been getting from listening to your shows?
I'll probably just be sending out a list of episodes, but one of the plans, so I'm going to be doing it with Context Travel probably. And one of the things that we'll be doing is Zoom calls, which is this is not something I would have done probably before the pandemic, but everyone's kind of used to it now. So we'll do Zoom calls before the tour, kind of explaining a lot of the places we'll be going to. Because the whole point of the trip is that we're going to try to visit places that most tourists never get to see, like the necropolis under the Vatican. Which is like limited to like 10 people at a time. And it's very small.
So how will that work? So you'll be able to sell tickets to your trip virtually and you'll have a guy who's coming around with a camera for the Zoom, or how will that work? What will they see?
No, we're just all sitting at our computers and we just talk about the places we are going to go on the trip. And we just give like more of a lecture. We may have experts come in to talk about it.
Sure.
Hector, well, the Zoom travel, Jan, I like your idea about the Zoom travel. So if the host of the travel show is actually on location and can also showcase what's around there, that's an interesting approach as well.
Absolutely. I was just going to ask you if you've done any virtual touring from Greenland during the pandemic or have any plans to while you're waiting still another year for the cruises to start and everything to kick back up again.
Yeah, it's an idea that has come up. We haven't done it, though. We have been recording some 360 experiences in different places in Greenland that we plan to publish and make available for people so they can get a taste of Greenland without going there. But there are a lot of interesting options like that. And also,
No, I'm just excited. I think there's an opportunity for live virtual events. So it's not just taped and TV like, but actual meet us here, meet us at this city center, meet us at this in the middle of the village, meet us at this coffee shop, meet us at this restaurant, meet us on the docks in real time on this particular Saturday.
Yeah. I don't know if you saw what the Faroe Islands did. And now I'm talking about one of the competitors, but we also have a good collaboration with them. But they did a brilliant thing during the COVID, which was kind of like a video game. So there was a person that was planted somewhere on the island, and then you could control that person via your phone and tell them to go forward, go left, go right, and see what they were experiencing and seeing there with an actual real person in real time at the location. It was a brilliant approach, and I really liked it. But it's maybe not scalable.
I love this idea. I know you don't want to talk about your competitor, but I didn't catch the name of the island. What was the name of the island?
The Faroe Islands. The Faroe Islands. They're doing brilliant marketing. I love them. So,
So then the question is, who? They provided the destination, but who was doing the capturing? Who was the gaming component? And then is that company going to branch out to other destinations?
Well, that's a good question. So they did it on their own. At the Visit Faroe Islands. So you could just sign up for a time slot and then you could control that person and walk around on the islands. But it's a nice version of what we're talking about here.
Churchill, Manitoba does this. They have live cams of polar bears, and in the summers they do it with the beluga whales that come in from Hudson Bay. And they'll have live cams that people can follow. And they've been doing that for years, actually. I remember back in 2010, I was in Bangkok, and I was having a meal, or I was having hot pot, and I live – this was before streaming was a thing – and I streamed a meal of me eating hot pot, talking to people, and I had like 150 people watching it at one point. And this is before like Twitch and stuff. So,
Gary, how did I miss this? Gary, I don't know if I could get an audience for people watching me eat in Carlsbad or go to coffee shops or go to different restaurants, but I would love that kind of work. Even if it was a small amount of people. But that bridges over to, you mentioned Twitch. Is there a category for Twitch travel?
There is, but it's not big. I mean, there are people that are – there's a lot of tools that were used by video game people that are starting to broaden into other things like Discord and Twitch. But it's still not big. And someone sitting in front of their computer talking is still the primary thing that you do on Twitch. So I think there's potential available, but I don't know how much of it's going to be walking around a city. I mean, could be
Gary,
done.
When you're at the SATW, I want you to see if you can get any minds to have a brainstorm about the intersection of gaming plus travel.
But
I think
that
would be
really
interesting.
Here's one of the problems, Jen. Travel tourism, the marketing people in travel, are always woefully behind everything that's happening. So if you had a big following on Twitch and you were to go to most destinations, they would stare at you blankly because they don't know what Twitch is.
Honestly. Yeah, but then again, you dominate the platform, and you can really grow with the platform. If it's a platform that's going to grow and going to branch out like you talk about, whether it's Twitch or Discord, it's an opportunity to be one of the first movers. And I mean, we were both on Twitter when Twitter was starting, and these are fantastic times, and seeing how the growth was. And if you were placed in the right spot at the right time, you could really grow with the medium. We are seeing then later on the same with Instagram and most recently with TikTok. So this is also something that is really interesting to look at. Can you be part of a new trend that's arriving and really dominate that platform in terms of travel destinations?
With tourism marketing, what they seem to care about is having a big public number. Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, they have a number that they can see and they can say, ah, that's big. We've been doing this podcast for 12 years and almost no one has ever cared about it, even though when I meet people in person, the podcast is always the first thing they mention. That it has a qualitative impact far greater than looking at a photo for 10 seconds on Instagram. Same with email marketing. And I've heard this from so many people. You can have a great email list, which is the most powerful thing you have, but no one cares, because one of the problems with tourism marketing is it's impossible to show an ROI, really. You don't know.
It's true.
If someone visited your desk, you don't know why they visited. They may have visited because of the exchange rate or because they got a deal on something, not because of what happened. Whereas with a product, you can tell if someone makes a sale. And so one of the problems is they tend to just do whatever is sexy and popular, because ultimately the success of a marketing campaign depends on pleasing the people who are running your organization, not actual success metrics. And so that is why they gravitate to things like Instagram and TikTok. And there is value there. I'm not saying there isn't, but they do it simply because, oh, well, that's what everyone's doing. It's like, remember when CNN had their airport network and you'd go through an airport and like every ad was for like Seoul or India or, you know, some international destination. And it's the old saying, no one ever got fired for hiring IBM. And if you have $1 million for television advertising and you throw it at CNN or the BBC or something like that, no one will raise an eyebrow because they know what CNN and BBC are, even if it's not effective.
Yep.
I'm going to end my rant about that.
No, but it's very true. And we're in the fortunate situation of not having any money to throw at IBM or CNN or any of those. So we need to think innovatively in our approach and really measure our success on other things. We do a lot of media relations and stories, the stories that captivate people and travel on their own. But I mean, we've seen this even in Iceland. I maybe in Iceland, I meet a German tourist, let's say a woman that's in her 40s or her 50s. And if I ask her why she comes to Iceland, she says it's because of Nonnet Money, which was a TV show about two young boys that had horses in Iceland, very popular in Germany in the 80s. And it's been her dream since she was a teenage girl watching them. So it's very hard to measure the impact and what it really is that sparks that first interest. And I think culture is underestimated when it comes to travel marketing. But it can be really powerful, whether it's a film or literature or music or something else.
I want to keep talking about this a little bit because I think the measuring stick here is about monetization, right? So the destination needs to measure where their money is being spent and how, like you said, how they're going to get their ROI. And the influencer needs to figure out how can they maximize their money on what they're doing. And I think what we were just talking about, if we're talking about streaming or the intersection of gaming and travel or Twitch and travel, what I'm seeing is a new opportunity to sort of be in this space and make it fun and experiment and see if there's a following, see if there's any interest. But it seems like the conversation naturally tends to jump ahead to money, 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 visitors, visitors, visitors. But when you're brand new in a space, there's got to be those people that just jump in and try it first.
Yeah, it's too much about volume and quantity. And I can take an example. I bought a cheeseburger once in Iceland. Which wouldn't be big news, but it became big news later because it's the last cheeseburger in Iceland. So McDonald's closed down, and I kept the burger. And then I put it on display later on so you could watch it on a webcam and see if it would rot or not, which it, of course, didn't. So it's 11 years now.
Really?
Almost 12 years old, and it looks like new. You can find it online. But the interesting thing is that this went viral all around the world, and we got in 1 month over 2 million visits to the website of the hostel where I had put it on display. Fantastic numbers. If you really want to see a return on investment, and I mean, I paid like, you know, $2 for the cheeseburger, and we got 2 million visits. So that's a good return on investment, isn't it? Well, reality was, of course, that this wasn't the target group. So out of the 2 million, I don't know, maybe 2 or 3 came to visit the hostel or stay at the hostel. So that wasn't really a good investment. Well, was the biggest benefit of this for the hostel were the backlinks that we were getting because we were hosting the webcam on the same domain. We all of a sudden got links from news websites all around the world. And the hostel dominated the search results for years after that. That was the big value because that you could then measure again and see, oh, we are getting 17% of our bookings now organically instead of 3% before or something like that. So it's about thinking, okay, where is the target group? Who is it that we're trying to attract? And like in the terms of Greenland, we have very limited capacity, both when it comes to flights to the country and also how many people we can accommodate here. So for us, it's much more about the quality of the tourists that come here rather than the quantity. So we focus on adventure tourism. That's our thing, and that's what we want to attract. We are not really that interested in other tourists, and it doesn't really fit the destination. But this is also important when you choose the channel that you're doing and where you're experimenting.
Let's talk about quality tourists. One of the things that's happened in the pandemic is a lot of destinations have changed their visa policies to allow remote workers to come and stay. So you could come for, say, 6 months up to a year, and just work there. You get an apartment or something. Is this something that you think would be a fit for Greenland? Is it something that, you know, are there even places for people to stay?
There are. It's not very fitting for Nuuk because there is a shortage of housing in Nuuk. So it's not really an option here. But there are other towns in the country where this could be a very interesting option. In particular, with people that really want to challenge themselves and try living in Arctic environment and see how they survive or adapt. So that's absolutely an interesting option. We haven't run any particular campaigns on that And I don't know if we will, but it is definitely an interesting option to look into.
Tell us about some of the activities. You talked about adventure tourism in Greenland. Give us some of the more usual experiences, and then also if you have an extreme adventure, what can they have to experience?
Well, we can start with the most popular activities here. That's clearly sailing into the ice field of Ilulissat. That's probably the most popular destination in the country, where you can see Titanic killers, since we were looking at Titanic earlier. That's where it's estimated the iceberg came from, that sank Titanic. Nobody knows for real, though. But they are huge. It's the largest ice-producing fjord in the world, and it's just, it blows your mind how big these icebergs can be. They can even be hundreds of meters in height, and that's just, you know, what's above the surface. And then you think about, what is it, 90% that's under the surface? It's madness. It's absolute madness. It's really hard to understand the size of it. Dog sledding is one of my favorite activities. Just sitting on the dog sled with the dogs running on the snow, and the other just silence that's there, and the vastness of the landscape. And just being here is a big experience, because the light is different. The colors are different. The reflection of the sea and the snow is different. And even in the wintertime, when you imagine maybe that it's dark because there isn't sun in the middle of the winter, there is still light, and it's so beautiful. And if you're into photography and you like the golden hour and the blue hour, these hours take hours in Greenland. They are so long, and you can get such fantastic images. So, photo tours are, of course, very popular here as well. Hiking, it's a very good hiking destination. You can even do skiing in the wintertime, cross-country skiing. And then it's the more extreme expeditions that are quite popular as well. Well, not popular, but interesting, whether you're crossing the ice cap, or you're doing some other activities. But I think for me, one of the big experiences was simply going onto the ice cap for the first time, because the size of it is so enormous. And you walk up to this ice, and you stand on this white piece of ice, and you can't see where it ends. And you know that it stretches maybe 600 to 1,000 kilometers over to the east coast of Greenland. And then you look to the left, and you know that the ice, it just goes on and on, 3,000 kilometers. And in the wintertime, it just continues to the North Pole and across and over to Siberia. So all of a sudden, you become somehow part of these planetary elements. You know, you have the sea behind you, it stretches to the south. If you go straight south, it goes all the way to Antarctica. You have the snow that you're standing on, and it's actually, you know, you touch the snow that touches the North Pole. And then you have the night sky, and just seeing the stars here. Imagine, light pollution is always a challenge when you're trying to see the night sky, or if you want to see the Milky Way. There are not many places where you can see the Milky Way, because there's always a city nearby that pollutes your vision. Here, the nearest big city is usually a minimum of 2,500 kilometers away. So it means that the light pollution is pretty much zero. And it's amazing how many stars you can see, and you know, the satellites, the shooting stars, and then when the northern lights come in, it's just fabulous. It's absolutely amazing.
Well, what is the best time of year? What's the best time of the year for seeing the northern lights in Greenland?
It has to be dark in the nighttime. So we have the midnight sun. So in June and July, there is no darkness. It's like midday all night long. It starts to get dark in August, depending on how far north you are. And so you should be able to see the lights maybe from mid or late August. So now it's full season. If you have clear skies, you can see the northern lights almost every single night.
Wow.
And because it's a high pressure area, we usually have clear skies. So the chances of seeing the northern lights are very, very good in Greenland.
I'm
Northern Labrador a few years ago, and I was able to see the Northern Lights quite clearly in late August. So I would assume it would be the same in most of Greenland, because that's even at a higher latitude.
Yep, correct.
Gary, how many different destinations have you been in and seen the Northern Lights? How many different areas or countries or cities?
One. I've had horrible luck. So I've been on a Northern Lights trip up to Churchill. We had clouds the whole time. I didn't see anything. I went to a special trip in the Yukon where I was on a special flight that was going to be like a Northern Lights sightseeing flight. And yeah, you could kind of see them from the air, but it wasn't very good. It was just kind of off in the distance. It was very light. But the only time I've really, really seen it was when I was in Labrador. I've had very bad luck whenever I've been in Northern Latitudes about Northern Lights.
Need to get you on a Northern Lights tour to Greenland then.
I will drop everything I'm doing for an opportunity to go to Greenland. That is something it's actually very high on my list of that and the Faroe Islands are both very high on the list of places I want to visit just because they're so photogenically beautiful. I know Greenland has the largest national park in the world as well by area. A lot of people don't realize that.
Yeah, that's correct. It's bigger than most countries.
All right. We have a segment on the show where we do a pick of the week. So it can be anything. It could be a product, a website. Just a travel tip, and I'll give you a little bit of time to think about it. I'll start it off, and I'm going to recommend something that I just got off Amazon this week. I have a not brand new. I've had it for a few months. A brand new M1 Apple MacBook Air, and it runs on USB-C, which is actually rather nice now that I have it. It just has USB-C ports, and I have an iPhone 12. Which it's lightning, but the other end is USB-C. So I ended up getting a 2-port USB-C charger off Amazon, and I got a 40-watt one from Anker. And these are really nice because you can charge at wattages that are much bigger than what you were used to if you were using like USB 3. And it would take a long time to charge something up. With this, I can charge my laptop or my phone pretty quick. Like I can get my phone up to half charged within 30 minutes. And having two ports on this really helps because I don't have to swap around anymore. So I would definitely recommend getting a good USB-C charger. And if you don't have any USB-C stuff, you probably will the next time you upgrade your phone or the next time you upgrade your computer, because that's where everything is going now. And USB-C is actually becoming kind of universal. The EU just talked this week about requiring USB-C basically in everything. So everyone would just have one charger. So and it pretty much is in everything at this point. So definitely look into that. And it cuts down on what you have to travel with. This trip I'm going on, next week for the SATW convention in Milwaukee, I'm just taking this tiny little charger. Normally, I have a giant power brick that I would have with a laptop. I could literally carry everything in my Scotty vest jacket. So makes life a lot easier. USB-C charger. Jen, you got something for us this week?
I do. Hot off the presses. I just found out that Disney, I guess, partnered with Alexa, and now they are having a voice assistant where you can say, "Hey, Disney," into your Alexa and get information back about Walt Disney World. And as silly as that sounds, I think a lot of people are going to use that. And I'm wondering what other travel destinations or travel specific sites are using Alexa in that way. But yeah, just found out Walt Disney World visitors, they're installing in the resort hotels this Alexa where they can say, "Hey, Disney," and get all sorts of information. Park hours, fastest way to get to the theme park, just interact with characters and get interactive trivia. And I think the kids are going to love that.
You should be able to play this podcast on an Alexa. I know I set up my other podcast to be an Alexa shortcut. So you could just say, Alexa, play Everything Everywhere Daily podcast. And hopefully a bunch of them just started.
I like that. So I'm picturing now someone talking to Alexa saying, hey, Greenland, how do I fly from Milwaukee to Nuuk? And then Alexa answers with the travel plan or, you know, what's the best time of the year to do dog sledding? It would be good.
Exactly. Yes. So what is that? Do you have to partner with Alexa for that? Or is there a way for people to program in their data?
No, you can do it yourself. With a podcast, it's super easy. In fact, most podcasts are probably already in there through Amazon Music. But if you wanted to create like I forget what the word they use, but it's like an app, but it's not really. But yeah, you can just do it yourself. It's not super hard. It depends on also what you want it to do. So it might require a bit more if like you wanted to do a Hey Greenland type thing to specifically look up certain flights or whatnot. But yeah, it can be done. It's not as hard as you think.
I like that. I think everybody should do that.
Yeah, I'll look into that. Definitely. That's interesting. So, I don't have a tech product that I can recommend. So I'm going to go in the absolute opposite direction. And I'm just going to go with what I love the most, which is non-tech. And because I've lived in the tech world like you do, been on social media for a very long time with the constant buzz of notifications. So I really, really enjoy going off the grid once in a while. And my favorite experience is dog sledding and doing dog sledding here in Greenland with the locals, where you go with an Inuit hunter on the dog sled. You drive on the ice. There is no sound, but, you know, just the paws of the dogs and their breathing when they're running through the snow. The little squeak sounds in the sled itself. And then you lie there on the reindeer skin. You have your polar bear trousers on to keep you warm. Then you enjoy the northern lights above you. And it's just an out-of-this-world experience. It's really, really something, and takes you away from all the stress and the buzz back home in the city. So that's my recommendation for this.
I will second that recommendation. I've been dog sledding, and I've always said to people, it's like, what are some of the coolest things you've done? And I've done a lot of really neat stuff. And dog sledding is one of the most fun times I've ever had. I did it up in the Yukon, and I've done it in Manitoba, and it was great. And those dogs, there's no gas pedal. They just want to run.
I mean, the power and the eagerness in pulling the sled, that's what they live for. And it's always my favorite mode of transportation. I've tried pretty much everything except the space shuttle, and I'm not even sure a space shuttle would outdo the dog sled. But that's the only challenger that I can see.
We should mention since we'd last did a show, SpaceX actually flew 4 regular civilians into orbit. And this wasn't one of these Jeff Bezos, we're going to, you know, 15 minutes up and down type thing. They actually went into the highest orbit that any humans have been on since the Apollo program. And like one of these guys was a billionaire and kind of funded it, but he wasn't an astronaut. And the other 3 people just, they won a contest for St. Jude's Hospital. And I think it didn't maybe get as much attention as it should, but it was really a profound time where this was a totally private human space flight. NASA had nothing to do with it. It was just SpaceX doing it on their own. And it was pretty significant.
It's a really, really big thing. And that's the next big frontier when it comes to tourism. That's space tourism. And I know it sounds utopian for a lot of people, but it is real. It's not something in the future. It is actually happening right now. Sure, it's billionaires at the moment, but it will become more and more affordable. So it will be soon an upper class experience.
How do you think, what is going to be the barrier to entry for that? Like, do I have a shot? If I could come up with the money, do I have a shot at it within 10 or 15 years, or would I be completely aged out of it? In 10 years, yep. I would be 60. So is that too old physically?
William Shatner is going into space in like a month or two, and he's 90.
Yep.
What? He's 90?
Yep. It's going to be a suborbital flight. But so here's what I if there's a chance for a normal person, SpaceX is working on a thing called their Starship, which is a very large two-stage rocket. And it'll be the first 100% reusable rocket, which is important because the reason why spaceflight's so expensive is because you're basically all the rockets have been disposable. Imagine going on a flight and having to buy a new plane every time you flew. That's basically what spaceflight has been. So with the Starship, they have different models of it. One would be just a tanker for, you know, bringing fuel to space. But another is for passengers, where they have literally they could fit 100 people in this. And traditionally, spaceflight, you'd have maybe three. I think the space shuttle could have seven. And that was it. So this would be like 100 people. And the Starship is going to radically reduce the cost of putting things in orbit. So not only is it the largest rocket ever made, but it's also going to be the cheapest, which is paradoxical, but it's because it's completely reusable. So
yeah,
when they do that, and you can divide it 100 ways, maybe. You know, 10 years from now.
Absolutely. In my mind, there is no doubt about it. And you can look at other companies as well. There's a lot happening in that industry. Axiom Space is another example. They are actually already designing a hotel, which is supposed to be ready and operational by 2024. That's in 3 years from now. It will be attached to the space station. And they're going to take regular tourists there. Of course, wealthy tourists, but still regular tourists there. So if you can come up with the money, you can go to space and you don't have to wait 10 years. So it's absolutely within our lifetime. And Jen, I think William Shatner is old, is aging much faster than we are. It must be.
I can't believe that 90. But Hector, before we conclude, tell us a little bit more about where – I want to keep this conversation going about the future of travel and what's next. Tell us where we can find your book and where we can purchase it and more details on that, please.
Well, you can find the book on Amazon. It's called Aftershocks and Opportunities 2, Navigating the Next Horizon. And in my chapter, I talk about the future of tourism and how the pandemic has impacted it. So you will be able to read about new trends, the trends that are accelerating, how we are going to use technology to respond to that and to navigate the different needs of the customer today. And I also talk about the millennials, how they are thinking differently and what they will be looking for in their travel experiences, something that we really need to take into account when we're thinking about product development within tourism now. And of course, there's a lot of other very interesting chapters on different topics. I mean, you spoke about Bitcoin earlier. So there's also some chapters about cryptocurrency and the impact that that can have, safety and security issues, and so much more. So it's really a thought-provoking book. And I always love reading future scenarios and seeing people's different ideas and wondering what is going to be reality in the future. So a good thought exercise.
Speaking of Bitcoin, and I know this is Jen saying, I think tourism may be an area where people may start to have a practical application for it sooner rather than later. Jen, I'm sure you've seen what's been happening in El Salvador. They made it an official currency in the country. And
yes,
you can use it at McDonald's and Starbucks. They just use the Lightning Network. It's super easy. And the other thing that's happening is that it is becoming the primary source of people sending remittances back home who work overseas because the fees are so low. It's basically, I think, going to do a number on Western Union. And, you know, you can the fees you get are really, really tiny, like, well, less than 1% if you use the Lightning Network. And so people are now, if they're getting remittances and you have a village of people that are getting a lot of remittances, it's becoming easier for them to just use Satoshis in you know, doing transactions with each other than it is to convert it into their local currency. And so if you're a traveler and you have something in your wallet, you know, a Bitcoin wallet, that may be the easiest way to get funds if you're overseas than an ATM or something else, which usually has high fees. That'll still be available, but it's something that at least is going to be an option going forward.
Gary, you're making – I can't even tell you how happy you're making me by opening your mind to this. He has been so negative on this for years. What?
Well, I can tell you what changed my mind. It was the Lightning Network. And because that solved, I think, the fundamental problem with Bitcoin, which was the amount of transactions. They need something that can compete with Visa. And Visa can do tens of thousands of transactions a second. And Bitcoin could do 7. And you can't really get beyond that. But the Lightning Network can do more than Visa. I mean, it can just crush it. And so that really does change everything. And so, yeah, that's basically what did it. And if you don't – I recommend everyone – If they don't know what I did since, you know, the last show is I just opened up a wallet, or I started I think I used Blue Wallet. You got to go through a process of verifying who you are and stuff. And I put like, you know, $40 in it and just started, you know, so I put some liquidity into the node that I started. I've been buying a few things. There's some, you can actually use it for micropayments on some websites. I'm sure you've been to a website where it's like, oh, you got to buy a subscription and it's, you know, $12 a month. And you don't want to get a subscription. You just want to read the article. Well, there are some places now where you can just buy the article for 10 cents using Lightning, and it's fast and it's cheap. 10 cents, no problem. That's, you don't even think about that, right? So it's, yeah, it's definitely has potential.
And in another future episode, we really ought to get somebody on to talk about Miami Coin and somebody to talk about what's going on with the Bitcoin space in Miami, because that's interesting too. I think, Hector, you have a friend from who's also included in your book that we might be able to get on.
Yeah.
Related to that. I forget what his name is, but yes. Yeah, so our listeners, you might have more of this combined interest, this intersection between Bitcoin and travel, and Gary and Jen in the future. And Gary, you got to test out the tipping.
There's a whole TV series on Bitcoin in Miami, isn't there, called Startups? Quite interesting. I don't know if you've seen that one, but it's I enjoyed
it. I started to see it. It's pretty sexy.
it is. I like it. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's wrap things up. Jen, where can people find you online?
They can find me online at BitCuriousMom. And I even started a BitCuriousMom TikTok channel recently. So I'm starting to branch that out. And also, now that we're doing these shows again, I'll start ramping up my Twitter at Jen Leo.
Okay. Holger? Where can people find you online and learn more about Greenland?
Yeah, visitgreenland.com is the best place where you can read everything about Greenland, and you can also find my contact information there. You will also find me on Twitter and Instagram and other social media, just as Hjortur.
Yeah, I know you've been on social media for quite a long time. An OG, yeah, as you will.
Yeah, we connected plus probably 13 years ago on Twitter somewhere originally.
And as usual, you can find me over at everythingeverywheredaily.com. My most recent episode was How Close Did the Nazis Get to Actually Developing an Atomic Bomb? And I, too, am on TikTok. I've been killing it recently. I doubled my audience in the last 2 weeks.
What? What's your handle? Everywhere Everything Daily?
No. It's what was it? Everything Everywhere Cast. Yeah, I'm almost up to 4,000 followers. I don't do anything. Oh, Everything Everywhere Cast, yeah. And all I do is I put the intro to my podcast with an image and some text, and it's been starting to work. I mean, it's really been the last week I've really been gaining traction. And the thing I discovered is that TikTok is far better than Instagram for one reason, in that you can share – things can go viral on TikTok, and they can't on Instagram. You can't share things. Mm-hmm. So that's the main advantage TikTok has. But anyway,
so Gary, you're just clipping these audios, but do you do any of the fun stuff? Do you add the stickers? Do you add the little, you know, the little animations? Do you do any of that?
No, Jen, I'm not fun. I'm talking about some very serious issues and of history. And, I may actually change the way I'm doing some of these videos and put a little bit more production into it, because right now I'm literally just taking a clip of the podcast, putting an image, and that's it. But I'm getting enough traction, and I'm getting tens of thousands of views on some of the videos now. Yeah, maybe I will put a little bit more effort into it, because I do see some sort of impact to the downloads of the show from what's happening on TikTok. And it's the only social media platform where I can see that. So I may end up putting more effort into it. But
well, I only just started, so my numbers aren't quite there yet. But I did hear that when you post 2 times a day on TikTok, your numbers start moving higher and higher. Hector, is Visit Greenland on TikTok at all yet?
Nope. We are not, unfortunately. So that's
well, we really
new platforms we're looking into.
We really push the envelope with you this time, trying to get you to get into possible virtual tours and TikTok and Alexa as well. Which one might be the easiest?
Yeah, my digital team is not going to be happy. They're overloaded already, but we look into it anyway. These are very exciting options, clearly.
All right, then, let's finally wrap it up. Till next time, stay tuned for another episode of This Week in Travel.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts.